Before we get into the show, a note that this episode contains descriptions of harmful situations that some people may find disturbing. Please take care while listening. I'm Dr. Nwezi Ndukwe.
And I'm Dr. Danielle Hairston.
This is the next 72 hours.
So Nwezi, in prep for this episode, I've come across a lot of the sentiment that the Black community seems to be distrustful of the medical system. And that's what really led me into, we need to bring this to the public. Is it really that Black people don't trust medicine? Or is it that the U.S. medical system has a history of disrespecting, disregarding, and losing the trust of the Black community? Those two things are very different.
They are very different, and it wouldn't be the first time. There's so many examples of the U.S. government using Black people as experimentation, lying to Black people in the name of science. And there's some things that people are very familiar with. One thing I think that is really common right now in terms of Black people not trusting science or not trusting the science that's being put forth by the U.S. government is to do with the COVID vaccine.
Right. And again, medicine and science have lost the trust of the Black community. When we think about the history, when we think about everything that's going on, it's not surprising that people are hesitant about taking this COVID vaccine. People are very familiar with, I see it thrown around a lot, the Tuskegee experiment. But there's some misunderstanding about that. Sometimes people think that Black people were given syphilis, but that's not what happened in this case. So Black men specifically with syphilis went untreated so they could see what the effects of syphilis were on people. So that's how we know about neurosyphilis and all the toxic and negative symptoms that are associated with it. However, this wasn't a vaccine, but it was the mistreatment of Black people and withholding medical treatment from them.
And when it comes to syphilis, I know we just mentioned that the U.S. government in that case with Tuskegee wasn't giving people syphilis, but there were definite examples where they were giving people syphilis. In Guatemala, the U.S. Defense Department used Guatemalan soldiers and insane asylum patients and were actually giving them syphilis, in some cases directly inoculating it into their penis. And we're basically trying to see how the bacteria was affecting their bodies, and also to see whether or not penicillin would be a good treatment. So it's not above the U.S. government to actually give people syphilis, even though that didn't happen in Tuskegee.
Okay. That's a lot. I didn't even know about that one. But we are also familiar with the story of Henrietta Lacks. And without Henrietta Lacks, without her consent, but without Henrietta Lacks, we wouldn't know most of the things that we know about GYN treatment now. It's happened throughout history, all across the country, in every state, in every age group. And this experimentation that we're aware of with Tuskegee, with Henrietta Lacks, is really just the tip of the iceberg, Nwezi. There's even more cases of medical racism and experimentation in our history. So I can see why people are hesitant. I can see why there's a resistance to getting a vaccine, because again, the U.S. medical system has let Black people down time and time again in every state, across the country, in every age group, and across all medical specialties.
And it's pretty sickening because, you know, a lot of these things people might say, oh, it's done in the name of science. Oh, it's done in the name of, you know, for the greater good. But it's not just in the medical field. There was even experiments and tests done on Black prisoners to test the effects of sulfuric acid, which is one of the additives in molasses. Everyone loves molasses, but they were checking to see if this food additive was going to be harmful. So they used Black prisoners to test out this theory. So it's not just about medicine.
Right. As we know, as I say all the time, racism is embedded in every single fiber of this country. Medicine, food, education, property, home ownership. So none of this is surprising to me. And I don't like molasses. All right. On this episode, we're going to look into the history behind the Holmesburg prison experiments in Philadelphia that has led to generations of hurt and mistrust. I know many of you out there are like, what is Holmesburg? You don't know about it. But for those of you who have grown up or have family or friends in Philly, buckle up. We're in for a story right here.
I'm My name is Alan Hornblum, and I am the author of several books dealing with medical ethics, including Acres of Skin, Sentenced to Science, and Against Their Will. Holmesburg Prison is the infamous county jail of Philadelphia, built in 1896 and finally emptied of prisoners in 1995. I start working there September of 1971. And when I walked into the prison, it was a very hot September day. The inmates, many of them were shirtless. Tremendous amount of yelling and screaming and noise and calls being brought forth on the intercom system. A lot of music being played, and it was just a cacophony of noise taking place, a lot of shouting, screaming, curses, and to the naked eye rather than the ear, it was also pretty shocking. Demographically, if I can use that term, the jail was overwhelmingly minority. I'm going to say 80-85% African-American, about 10% Puerto Rican, about 5% white. But the other thing that was so obvious and a little bit nerve-wracking was that there were scores and scores of inmates strapped and wrapped in adhesive tape and bandages.
So the story of the Holmesburg experiments, as heinous as they were not very well known. Maybe this was because it was happening in a prison setting. Maybe it's because Dr. Albert Kligman was so revered and he was a member of the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania.
My first day working there, the very next day, while on A block at detention center, I asked John Reeves, one of the guards, what's with all of these inmates, you know, strapped and wrapped in bandages, you know, how did they all get hurt? You know, should I really reconsider working in this joint? And at this point, he just told me, look, it would be wise if you just forget about it. You have to understand you're new here, not these experiments. These have been going on well before I ever entered the institution. And in fact, they had been going on since 1951. I'm there now in 1971. So there were 20 years of human experiments to the point that there was a very accepting culture that were built around these medical experiments.
Those outside of the prison didn't really know what was going on. Those within the prison didn't have much of an alternative, like Leotis Jones.
My name is Adrienne Jones Alston, and I'm the oldest daughter of the late Leotis Jones. My father was in Holmesburg Prison for a receiving stolen property charge. It was a, what we call it, misdemeanor here. I don't know if y'all call it misdemeanor in Pennsylvania or petty larceny, but it was a misdemeanor charge that he was incarcerated for.
Was he willing to talk to you, his children, about what he went through in Holmesburg?
No, not in the beginning, because I was very young and I just picked up bits and pieces because I was like 5 or 6 years old. He's not going to sit down with me and explain to me what was going on. So through life, I picked up some of the things, but a majority of it I got later on in life. Some things he was too embarrassed to talk about.
At the three prisons, especially Holmesburg, you could find at least half, if not 75% of the jail inmates involved in experiments. The information they received from those doctors and technicians orchestrating the experiments, I really don't know. Some inmates didn't care. You had to understand that most of these men led pretty brutal lives as it was. Many of them had alcohol and drug problems. So They were used to sticking a needle in their arm. They were used to taking risks.
I know my father went through different experiments. He talked about, he explained to us about the experiment with the tape and the lights. It was different types of experiments he participated in. Stuff with his feet and different things. It was different types. The only thing I didn't hear him say, he didn't drink anything, but he always did something. It was either with his feet or looking at lights and tape and all kinds of crazy stuff. Yeah. Injections.
I was just fascinated by it because I had never seen a large scale clinical trial, but that's what it was. And in the subsequent days and weeks and months, I'd be teaching a literacy program, which is the reason I was there. I ran a literacy program, adult basic education for the inmates at the detention center. And when these inmates would come in to my class and they had adhesive tape on their arms or their chest or legs or whatever, I'd ask them, what's this test for? And I'd ask them what they're getting for it, why they're doing it, and so forth and so on. And they would confirm that they needed the money. Their family didn't have money, and this was the only way you could earn it. If you were lucky enough to get a job at a prison on a cell block pushing a broom, you made all of 25 cents a day. However, if you sold them a piece of your skin, and patch tests were the most common test in the joint, you could make a dollar a day. Some experiments, like the Army experiments, paid $2 a day. Those were princely wages.
The main reason he participated in those experiments was to survive in prison. He didn't have money, you know, and that was the biggest part of it, you know, because I know being in prison, the prisons barely feed you, you know, so you want that commissary. So he did what he had to do, you know, like most inmates, if they have an opportunity to make money while they're incarcerated, they're going to do it. So he did what was available. He took advantage of what was available, not thinking about repercussions.
And back in the day, these men, even when they offered themselves up, they were never told what they were being doused with or injected with. And in some cases, if they were, they were deceived and lied to. I found no one in all the men I interviewed who knew that they were injected with dioxin. None of the men knew that they were injected with radioactive isotopes. None of the men were told the specifics of what chemical warfare agents they were given. And even if they did know, they wouldn't know what the hell it meant to be hit with heavy levels of atropine or scopolamine or something like that. They know that these men were desperate. They were prone to risky behavior. They were overwhelmingly minorities. They knew that they didn't have connections. And, you know, you could almost argue that they could get away with murder. And in some cases, they probably did.
So, Danny, you caught that, right? Basically, the inmates did not have any idea what they were being injected with. The guards knew, the researchers knew, even the businesses had some idea of what was going on, but the actual people who were being experimented on had no idea what the hell was going on. So that brings us to the idea of informed consent. Now, informed consent, for those who don't know, is the process in which healthcare providers or researchers educate a patient about the risks, benefits, and alternatives to whatever intervention they're going to use. Now, the important thing is that the person that they're informing has to be competent, but also has to make a voluntary decision about whether or not they want to participate.
Right. And you have to tell them the truth. You can't tell them that they're being injected with perfume when it's really treatment for acne and, at the worst case, chemical warfare. But now, research with prisoners is governed by federal regulations that classifies prisoners as a vulnerable population. So their ability to make an informed and voluntary decision to participate in research is compromised. So that's no longer allowed.
It's crazy that it took so long for them to realize that.
It is.
Many of the inmates were so negatively affected by it that it was very common in the jail at that time to see inmates wearing little signs on their prison uniform stating, "My name is Alfonso Johnson, and I am part of the U.S. Army Penn Studies. Please take me back to my cell block."
And even when they were released, they were not free from the clutches of these experiments. It goes to show just how detrimental these experiments were and the disregard for the individuals and their families who saw people that they loved become unrecognizable.
I talked to a number of inmates who told me that some of those experiments completely reordered their mind in the sense that their MO and criminal activity changed from relatively harmless to fairly dangerous, where they went from being a booster of sweaters and goods in a department store to carrying a gun and pulling off stick-ups, and that they admitted to beating up their wives and children.
What was it like to live with your father after Holmesburg? Like, how do you think Holmesburg affected your father both physically and mentally?
Well, the physical part was the first part that I experienced, because the first time I witnessed the scars on my father's back, his scars started at the back of his neck and went all the way down as far as I could see. I don't know if it was on his butt, but I could see his waistline, you know, when he take off shirts, and it scared me. When I first saw it, it scared me, and I wouldn't look at him. I ran because it was ugly. At that time, the treatment was like scabbish-like, but over the years, it just changed to a smooth scar, and his back looked like a leopard with spots. That was a physical part. So me being an adult now, I could see where the behavior changed, because my father went from a, he was soft-spoken. I never heard him curse. I've never heard my father curse. He never raised his voice at me before, you know, certain things happened. He was just a smooth guy. You know, he was smooth. He was a nice dresser. When you see him, he was suave, bopping, you know, he had that little Philly waffle bottom. And that's what I remember. You know, but it got ugly. And I didn't know what was wrong with my father, but I missed that guy after it changed. You know, he had, I can identify some things now. Always picking at my mother. Everything was a problem. It was an argument. Then sometimes it got worse than that. And I mean worse. You understand what I'm saying?
The impact of these experiments is far-reaching. It included generational trauma that impacted not just the prisoners, but also their children and the situations that they were in for the rest of their lives.
Everybody bought into it. Everybody found it kosher. But I still had this deep-seated feeling that there was a problem there, and always expected a medical ethicist, a journalist, historian to write the account. But the years are going by, the decades are going by, and by the early 90s, I'm now in the sheriff's office, still coming in contact with inmates. And I start thinking more and more about these experiments, and I start pulling some inmates aside, asking what they recall of it, and they would give me names of other people who more experiments, and one led to another. And then I start, you know, tracking down the doctors and the technicians, and then doing a full court press on all the documents using the Freedom of Information Act. So it became somewhat of a personal crusade to chronicle the history of Holmesburg Prison and the other prisons becoming a satellite of the University of Pennsylvania Medical School.
Now, we're going to switch gears a little bit and kind of focus a little bit more on the experiments and your knowledge of them. Can you tell us, what do you know about Dr. Albert Kligman?
I know Dr. Albert Kligman started out experimenting on animals. I know he started out like that until he was invited by another doctor at a prison to help him find a cure to an athletic foot epidemic that was at the prison. And when he went in there, he became something else. When Dr. Klickman went into that prison, he became something else.
He goes up there, and when he walks into Holmesburg and goes into the rotunda, which is a large area that leads to all the cell blocks, he, like me, was amazed by all the movement, all the men. But in his brain, a very entrepreneurial brain, recognizes that this would be an absolutely wonderful place to do skin experiments because you have an endless supply of test subjects and you have an arena, a walled arena, 35-foot fieldstone walls that nobody gets to see on the outside. So even if he should damage somebody, no one's going to know about it. So as he said to himself at the time and to others over the years, he saw these people as acres of skin. They were raw material for medical experiments. And little by little, over the years, it becomes a thriving cottage industry where he's able to take over part of a cell block and turn it into a lab.
He created a great product. I know that much because it's still making money. Penn's still getting their royalties from that discovery, but it's the early development parts of what he discovered that harmed a lot of people. And that's the piece that I want Penn to understand.
And like you said, you know, those experiments, they didn't just stay with them in the prison. They left the prison as well and affected families, you know, and again, had so distrust within the medical community between those people who were there and especially Black people who were there.
Because of her childhood experiences, Adrienne ended up in the system in foster care as well as incarcerated herself. She's now trying to pick up the pieces that really begun with the experiences of her father.
Do you think that there's any way that Penn, University of Penn, can make this right?
I would like them to take ownership for their part. I would like to see them do something for returning citizens, the citizens that are coming out of prison, help them get halfway house beds, you know, pay their first month rent or something. You know what I'm saying? Give something back.
And speaking about giving something back, to your knowledge, did your father ever receive any compensation, reciprocation, anything for what he endured while he was in Holmesburg Prison and for taking part in those experiments?
My father and one other inmate out of the hundreds won a small lawsuit. I think he got like $40,000. And the other guy got a payment, but it was two out of hundreds. And the other inmates didn't get a chance to get compensated because the judge said the statute of limitations had expired. So they was just overlooked.
And, you know, that's interesting because like you were saying, it didn't only affect your father. You know, the statute of limitations is affecting generations at this point. So this statute of limitations, seems as if it's, you know, arbitrary and doesn't really matter because it's affecting generations and generations.
Penn has to answer this. I would like them to answer this.
I think it's very important for you to share your story of your family and just for people to understand generations, because I think a lot of time now they say like, oh, Tuskegee experiment, that was 1920s, 1930s. 1940s, people need to get over that. Like, but this is something that here in Philadelphia, not in the South, in Philadelphia, Penn, supposed to be a predominant institution, was doing this to people who are still alive and are impacting generations, like you, Miss Adrienne, and your children, your father, and all these families in Philadelphia. I'm sure if we went through Philly neighborhoods, they will all say like, oh yeah, I know about Holmesburg. We're not doing that. And it's really impacting how willing people are to engage with medicine, with the field of medicine. Like if you literally know that your dad went through this, like Mr. Youssef, you don't want to go to a doctor. You're very weary about the situation.
I don't want to get the injection. Why would I trust it? I have heart disease. I have asthma. I have some of the high blood pressure. I have some of those conditions where I probably need to get it. But how the hell am I gonna trust that? I've never had an injection in my life unless it was medically necessary. You know what I'm saying? It had to be an emergency, but I'm not just going to go sign up for nothing. And it's a, and I should not feel like that.
And that feeling, that belief resonates through the community. The relatives of these men and women who were incarcerated and used, their siblings, their children, all have learned what doctors in white lab coats with PhD or MD after their name did to them, even prestigious institutions like Penn. So there is tremendous distrust generally of doctors and institutions. And even when they have a serious malady and probably should be seeing a doctor, there's tremendous resistance to it.
So we started this episode talking about Tuskegee and the COVID vaccine and how the medical community has lost the trust of Black people. Now, the Holmberg experiment showed us that we don't have to go as far back as Tuskegee to see examples of this. What does this experimentation say about the perception of Black people, Black bodies, and Black agency? To me, it says that the dehumanization of Black people has existed for all of history. Black people have been disregarded in the past and in the present.
And hopefully not in the future. Later this season, we're going to talk about experimentation on Black children. Yes, it happened. It happened in New York. It happened in the 90s. And a future episode is going to discuss Black children, perceived violence, and the carceral system. We're going to talk about the affiliation with Columbia, Mount Sinai School of Medicine, and fenfluramine.
Fenfluramine. Isn't that fenfen, the diet drug?
It is. The Next 72 Hours is hosted by Dr. Danny Hairston and Dr. Nwezi Ndukwe. Executive producer is me, Danny Hairston.
Senior producer is Susan Nyakundi. Producer is Karina Giamarese.
Do you know some cases we need to investigate? Things we need to look into? Things we really need to dig into? Email us at 72hourspod@gmail.com. Thanks again. See you next time.
See you next time.